Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
All right, guys, welcome back to the Rick Shields Golf Show podcast, episode 217. In today's episode, we've got a very special guest, Mr. Tommy Fleetwood. A few weeks back, pre-Christmas, we were out filming in Dubai. I got the pleasure and honour, and it really is an honour, to spend time with Tommy Fleetwood. He's one of the nicest guys in the world. He really is. And considering he's one of the best players in the world, it's quite rare. We get to sit down with him, chat about his goals, his ambitions, how the Ryder Cup was. You know, don't forget, he hit the iconic winning shot to retain the Ryder Cup before continuing to go on to win the Ryder Cup. So it's pretty special, really, really special. I think you're going to really enjoy it. Sit back and relax. Now, before we do get into that, I think it's also definitely worth a shout out for Nick Dunlap this weekend, winning the American Express, the first amateur to win a PGA Tour event for 30 plus years, all the way back to 1991. The last time an amateur won on tour, and that was Phil Mickelson. Now, Nick Dunlap has got an unbelievable pedigree. He's already the junior amateur champion and the amateur champion, and what his future holds only knows. I think the last player to have both the junior amateur championship and the main amateur championship was Tiger Woods. So I think this guy is going to go a long way. And also big shout out to Rory for winning his fourth Dubai Desert Classic this weekend in epic style. Really good. I think he could have gone back-to-back winning weeks. He could have potentially won the Dubai Invitational. But my man, the guy who's on the podcast today, Tommy Fleetwood, won it. Now, this, again, is pre-recorded. He hadn't won the Dubai Invitational at this point of recording. So just bear that in mind. But so sit back and enjoy this very chilled and relaxed chat with me and Guy and Mr. Tommy Fleetwood. We're kicking things off straight away. Thanks for coming back on the podcast.
Thank you. I've just said, actually, I'm a bit less nervous than last time.
You weren't nervous last time.
I was very nervous.
You were so chilled and relaxed. And you know what? In the last podcast that we did, which was like nearly 2 years ago now.
Yeah.
Was it?
Yeah.
It wasn't last Christmas.
No, it's the year before. No. Which is one of the most successful podcasts we've ever done. Mm. And still to this day, one of the snippets I got from that podcast was why a player relationship with a brand is so important, a club brand.
Oh, yeah, I do remember this now.
And it was almost like a mechanic for an F1 driver. And ever since, I'm like, yeah, it makes more sense to me now. But thanks for coming on, back on.
No,
we're
thank you.
In Dubai, here at the DP World Golf Performance Centre, the Tommy Fleetwood Golf Academy.
It's quite a mouthful, yeah. You get used to it. It's the Tommy Fleetwood Academy at the DP World Golf Performance Centre at Jumeirah Golf States, if you want the...
That was nice.
Full official. When you've said it, when you've had to say it enough times, like you get it.
Well, one thing, it's stunning. It's absolutely stunning. And it's not even... It's like so close to Dubai. We're staying in Dubai and it took like 15 minutes to get here today. There's two golf courses here, Earth Course, Fire Course. Mm. We've got a little match lined up today on the Earth Course.
Yeah.
Which I'm excited about. A rematch, a 10-shot challenge rematch.
I actually said you always seem to pick times when I've not practiced.
No, don't give me this stuff. And when is there a time that you don't practice?
Do you know what? I'm not doing that. People get their excuses in early when they're not confident, and I'm not going to do that. I take that back. Scratch that.
Well, you beat me last time, so let's see what happens.
I think we tied. It was a draw, wasn't it?
Was it a tie?
You made a double on
I think
the
you
last,
glossed over that, though, Rick. Very, very. When you said, oh, it's a little match, this is a huge match. The 10 shot challenge with Tommy, was it 4 point something million
views? It's still the most viewed 10 shot challenge we've ever done.
This is redemption today.
This is a big one. I'm excited about it. I'm probably not that I might show it on the golf course today, but I'm a little bit more chilled as well today.
What tees are we going to play at?
Whatever you want. Make it friendly, though.
We'll play a composite course.
Nice.
Anything exciting happened this year? Any kind of big event that happened? Kind of the back end of the year? Any iconic shots that you managed to pull out the bag? And
I don't know what you're talking about.
any US fans that are upset with you? How incredible was the Ryder Cup this year? I'm going to dive straight into that.
It was good. It was very cool. I think It's always like such a special time for us that are lucky enough to make the team or get selected for the team and then play. I think everything revolving around the Ryder Cup is extremely special. It meant a lot to the ones, you know, that were there at Whistling Straits, where the end of the day, like, we got an absolute, you know, thrashing. Yeah. And so I think this time just felt very satisfying. Felt like redemption. Mm-hmm. I think just ultimately 2 years ago, it's not that you get beat, it's not losing. Yeah. I think it was that we just felt like we didn't play like we could, we didn't do ourselves justice as a team. And then 2 years is a long time, and I think it happens every single Ryder Cup when one team has won. There's this, I don't know, everybody seems to like break it down and then plan on this, especially this time. I think if you look at if you go back to Whistling Straits, we were a team that didn't play like we could, and we weren't particularly, I think a lot of us, you know, barring a few, I'm not doing everybody a disservice, but a few of us weren't in form or playing as well as we'd like. The American team at the time felt like the Harlem Globetrotters pretty much. They were a very, very good team. And then I think most people had their mindset in that it was going to be a long time of American like domination, if you like. And
You showed them it's not.
From that perspective, and then from that point of view, I think we felt very, like, you know, very happy that we managed to get it back.
I was there all week, and I was there on the 16th hole in the grandstand on the left, and you stood down on that tee. And honestly, how you were feeling, I don't know. I mean, I was a few drinks in, so I was kind of quite excited.
You were good.
I was so nervous and excited and like I'm proud of you. Like, I'm still on that tee, and obviously we've had the opportunity to film together a few times, and I stood there on that tee and I'm thinking, or saw you on that tee and was seeing it on the big screen, I'm like, this is epic. When you looked around, and that hole, that 16th, an iconic hole, a short par four. So we actually played it about a month or so before the Ryder Cup, and we actually played with the course designer.
Oh, did you?
Yeah. And he was obviously Dave Sampson from European Golf Design. And he was talking about how he felt like that hole was going to be the real iconic hole, because it's risk reward. Yeah. I mean, every single golfer went for it. There's no real point in kind of laying up massively.
No, there's no real other shot. I actually remember playing it. I played the Italian Open in, I think, it might have been 2021. And they played it, there's a tee like a lot further back, and it was like a layup. I think we played two rounds of a layup and two rounds of a drivable par four. But at that point, you could really see 16, 17, 18, 15 as well, like the back of the green, the amphitheatre, so what a finish like the Ryder Cup was going to be. So I think you knew then like it was going to be really cool, and it's pretty certain 16 was going to be drivable all week for the Ryder Cup. It's just made for that.
So just explain it, and I'd love to hear your thought over that shot. You're there. You know at that point that your match is so incredibly important.
Like, you know at that point, surely, if you win that hole, you potentially secure the Ryder Cup for Team Europe. Yeah. Is that right? Is that what you felt on that tee? Did you know that at the time?
Yeah. It was one of them things, I think, from, like, when we were warming up in the morning. So I actually said, so let's go a bit further back. I don't want to be boring, but...
No, do. Listen, I want to
not boring
into, like, this story.
I remember saying to Claire on... at some point on Saturday, as players, or as European players anyway, you don't have a say in what position you go in or where you go. It was like, you know, Luke was very, very good at leading the team, and he involved you where he felt like you would like to be involved, but yeah, the rest of the time he took charge and everybody had their full trust in him. I remember saying on Saturday to Claire, I can't remember whether I was in the middle of play, like, what, you know, in between rounds, or whether it was at the end of the day, and I said, I know where he's going to put me and I don't want to play there.
Oh, really?
Well, it's like, it's just, so the singles is a very strange feeling in the Ryder Cup, because you've got all the build up and then you spend two full days where there's only four matches on a golf course,
yeah,
at any given time. 50, 60, 70,000 fans.
I know,
so
it's crazy.
Like, it's such a tight, and then the singles, you'll wake up and it's so spread out. And but in particular, like, if you're not out sort of say 1, 2, 3 or 1, 2, 3, 4, once you come to warming up, it's like hardly anybody around all of a sudden. And it's like,
so
really,
the atmosphere,
it's really quiet.
Drops off quite a bit.
And then you're out on the golf course and you're playing on your own horse. And it's a very, very different feeling. And I'm going to say, I was like, I know he's going to put me out at the back. So there's two things that are going to happen. Either it's all over, so then you're wandering around just wanting to get in, because you've won and you'll want to celebrate. Or it's not over and, like, it's going to have to come down to you, and it's not gone the way that we would like it in the singles. And then you have, like, an unexpected, like, pressure at the end. So there's those two things that can happen, really. And I was like, I don't really want to be a part of that. But
so you'd have preferred to be in the first three groups?
I'd have rather gone out a bit earlier, yeah. But I played 11 in Whistling Straits,
yeah.
And again, like, it kind of, your singles doesn't mean nothing. Like, you still got pride in your point and your result. But I remember we spoke about it a few times with Jordan. I played Jordan Spieth in the singles at Whistling Straits, and we were at 11. Ryder Cup was over, and we just spent the 18 holes kind of like, and as much as you try,
yeah,
it's just there's not, like, it's just very,
well,
difficult,
certainly,
to
if
get
it's,
up to it.
If it's one side and it's finished by,
yeah,
that point,
it's,
you're
it's
thinking
finished, and to be fair it got to like 15, 16, 17 and we're all square and the crowd were more around then because we were at the end, and then it got a bit more, like, you know a bit more intense, but it's just like it was kind of over, so that was always a possibility.
So does that spur you on, that kind of crowd motivation, that almost, I mean, I see it as being almost pressure. Do you see it as almost being able to soak in that atmosphere from the crowd?
Well, I think whatever you do, the crowd plays such a huge part in those moments. And I mean, if you take the 16th, for example, you know, one of the greatest shots that I'll ever hit, probably, and one of the greatest moments I'll ever have in my career. If there's not one person around, then it's not quite the same, is it? It's
no,
like,
that's true.
So I think for that, for those reasons, the crowd plays such a big part in what are the memorable moments and what are those.
Yeah.
So yeah, they do. They do play a huge part, yeah.
Just on that moment, though, like, obviously, it's to win the Ryder Cup, like, that is massive in itself, and like I said, a moment you'll never forget. But as a golfer already with a great career, but that must give you something moving forward, knowing you've been there in the biggest moment in golf, and you've had all those millions of people watching and tens of thousands around the tee. That must be a nice feeling going forward now, knowing you can do it on the biggest stage.
yeah, I mean, I've never felt so sick on a golf course for when you looked at the leaderboard and one of the things that came up in the team talk that night before was just don't you're going to look at the leaderboards, you're going to look at that, but don't fall in love with whatever the scores are. Don't think that those scores are the be-all and end-all, because actually in four balls, once you get to the, you know, the scores, if you're two or three up, it's very, very difficult to turn them around, because it's generally going to take a birdie or probably more to win a hole in four balls. So it's hard to change those scores. So when you see them, that looks like the real score. But in singles, bogey could win a hole, par could win a hole, and then you can have a rapid turnaround. So it's like, don't really, you know, worry about the scores, take care of your point. And I remember looking at the board on like the seventh or eighth hole, and it just, there was something about it, I don't know why, but it was like, it's going to come down. There was, it went Shane, me, Bob, the back three. I was looking at him and I was like, it's likely, not that it will, but it's all of a sudden, it's looking more likely than it could.
It was getting closer. So then, it's so the day realize, it was getting and really close.
And like in reality, I think we were always, somebody was always going to get the point.
Of course we were.
But like, not quite sure, and you're like, you just have to keep going, and when it does come down to, potentially it's going to come down to one of you, things start, you know, getting a bit more nervy and there's pressure on. And I did feel like from about the eighth or ninth hole onwards, felt very nervous. And I remember trying to eat a protein bar or something down 14, and I took one bite and I was like, nah, this isn't going to stay down, so I'll just leave it.
What does nerves feel like to you?
It's a very good question.
Like in a way, like
like nerves of doing a Rick Shields podcast, or like
no, you don't get bloody nervous. No. But I think because on the outset you're so chilled and calm, I almost can't ever envision you being nervous. But either you mask it or hide it very well. But what does it feel like to you? Because I obviously know it. Like I get shaky hands. I can almost like I can feel it with me. Is that the same with you?
Yeah, I think you're your heart rate's going, you're obviously, you know, very nervous. Like I could feel that one in the pit of my stomach, you know, throughout the whole back nine. You know, very, very nervous. And there's parts of you that are shaking and stuff. I think everybody might feel it in different ways, but I would say what comes with the nerves probably the same for everybody. There's nothing else to do, is there? But
When I look at tour pros and I see it in that amphitheatre, certainly around that 16th, I spent a lot of time on there enjoying myself, looking down on the players and just thinking, they're bloody superheroes.
Yeah.
You're superhuman. Well, because you don't look real in that. Yeah. You're like gladiators. And I know it was Rome. It was very kind of geared around that gladiator theme with the Colosseum. I love that wrap around that first tee with the Colosseum, that kind of art work. And again, I was on the first tee on the Friday, and just looking down, you're like, how? I can't comprehend how unbelievable every single player does. And I suppose that's hard work, it's dedication, it's all the hours you've put in the past. But it almost seems like you're so chilled and relaxed, and like, even like playing up to the crowd. Like, it's just awesome.
But with that though, is that something that you've seen in your career where you might have been either an elite junior or when you first turned pro, where there's guys who were great ball strikers, great golfers, but when it comes to handling those nerves under pressure, some people just almost melt, and some people like yourself can take that energy and use it positively?
I always think there's obviously like levels throughout your career from a junior and everything that you continue to try and move up to, and I think the margins in golf are incredibly small, but I think the amount of, I think it's probably something that's overlooked or underestimated. Like, I always think, you know, you look at the FedEx Cup, for example, is a very good example for me. So out of the millions and millions and millions of people that play golf around the world, even, you know, even in just America alone, 70 people made the FedEx Cup finals this year. It's a ridiculously tiny, you know, minute amount of players that would make them finals. Same on the, you know, on the DP World Tour, how many people keep the card, or how many people make, you know, the DP World Tour finals? It's such a tiny amount. Ryder Cup, 12 on each team. It's so small. So tiny things that will separate from, you know, making that team or having an amazing season or whatever that is. And whether that's, you know, something to do, you know, whether that's mental, whether that's, I don't know, the way that, you know, people practice, maybe that's a bit of luck. Mm-hmm. There's such tiny margins, and it's always difficult to put your finger on it. But of course, like, you know, there's something there that separates everyone. But what it is?
Well, you guys have got it. That's what you got. What was a better Ryder Cup for you, Paris or Rome? Or is that too hard? Is that like saying which is your favourite child? Is that almost too hard of a question?
It's a tough one. I think, you know, different. To be honest, all three of them for different reasons. Paris was my first one. Such a special like time and opportunity for me. Fran playing with somebody who was so close to me, getting off to that start.
But you did unbelievable. Were you undefeated in Paris?
Me and Fran were. I got hosed in the singles by Tony Finau, but we won by, you know, a really big margin, and it was so cool. I think Whistling Straits for the tough, you know, for such a tough time that we had on the course, I think that we, for different reasons again, we became so close off the course. And we drew on what time, you know, what the positives were that week. And it was amazing for that. So I think that, you know, that was great for many different reasons. And then this one obviously feels like very, you know, again, go back to the word satisfying, redemption, whatever it is. But felt like we did ourselves justice this time. On a personal level, like having... I always think, like, whenever the Ryder Cup comes along, you always see the winning moments of those Ryder Cups and those shots, like as if I was, you know, the one that got that opportunity out of everyone.
It's ridiculous. It's so good.
Like, it's still kind of weird.
Well, like I said, there was a couple of iconic shots. Obviously, your drive into 16, Rory's pitch on 17.
Yeah, I know.
Were you there for that shot?
Filth. I had such a poor view of it. I was really annoyed. I was like short right of the green. So I can't really see him, and then it's over, like, from us there's a bunker at the front of the green, so I couldn't even see it. So like the guys at the back and everything had an amazing view. All I've done is see it on TV.
I think it even kick-started with, was it Victor Hovland, whether he was one of the first groups out, he chipped in on the first hole.
Yeah,
I think it was the first group out, and then you suddenly think, oh my god,
I know.
It just set the scene, didn't it, straight away. Excited about Luke Donald being announced as captain again in 2 years time?
Yeah, I think he's perfect. And I just think, I think a lot was made of like the landscape of the European Ryder Cup team changing this time. Not necessarily the actual team that was lined up to play, but I think you look at the team, the vice captains and everything, what people would have expected 2 years ago. It was clearly very different, and I think effectively, like when I made the team in Paris, I feel like you're walking into that era of Ryder Cup legends, and you're walking into that team, and they were going to be here for a long time through vice captains to captaincy. And I think just with that, the way things have been and that changing and the landscape changing of the team, I think the continuity of Luke, who's been unbelievably successful, and then the team that will be around him, I'm sure there'll be a lot of similarities there. I think it was definitely the right thing to do for us.
We kind of got subbed in as captain after Henrik Stenson being kind of stripped of captaincy, so I feel like he needed a full run at it as well. Like,
I feel like he
needed that. No, you're fully captain this, you know, it's all yours this time.
Yeah, and I think like him and Diane, like, unbelievable job they did. He spoke so well. We had so much like respect for him, and he owned the room when he was in it. Diane was amazing. And I just think, I think it's harsh that people might look at him as being subbed in for that one, because I think when the Ryder Cup captain selection was going on, I think he was very close to getting it. Yeah. I think it was very like 50-50 almost between him and Henrik. So I'm sure it hurt when he didn't get it. And then I know he would hate to think that people would see it as that way. But look at the job he did with half a term to try and get things right. So, for him to just kind of continue. And I mean, like, if the team happens to win in Bethpage Black, it's got one of the best Ryder Cup legacies of all time. Like, it'll be amazing.
Do you find them with the Ryder Cup? Obviously, golf is such an individual sport. You know that better. Anybody growing up, it's on your own. There's some levels of team element for your county or for your country. The Ryder Cup is the pinnacle of that. Do you find that then moving, you find relationships and friendships through the Ryder Cup that kind of last throughout tour life, then that you become close to people from that week?
Yeah, you definitely, for the most part, you obviously have your friends that'll be, on tour, that you travel around with, that you're super close with, and that you've grown up with. But I do think, when you've played, when you've been in a Ryder Cup team with the players, there's a bond that you all have that lasts. You know that you've gone into battle together, essentially. Yeah. And what you've been through that week, it sounds daft. Look, I understand we're only playing golf, but it's so intense and it means so much, and there's so much for us as Europeans. I think we take a massive responsibility of carrying the legacy that's been going on for a long time. And I think it means so much to us. So when you've done all that together, there's definitely bonds that stay.
I mean, yeah. I've been very lucky to be to a lot of really big golf events this year, the Masters, the Open, but the Ryder Cup is just, as a fan,
it's different.
It is, as a fan, shot matters.
Yeah,
and every shot from the team you support, and you every time you look to the TV or you look to the golf course, it's like, please go in, please go in, please go in.
Yeah, yeah.
But the Open, sometimes if it's the third hole on a Friday, it's well, it doesn't matter if that doesn't go in.
Of course, yeah.
You're not as passionate about every single golf shot.
It definitely seems to appeal as well more to the casual fan. I have friends who are semi into golf, who'll maybe watch the Open, the Masters, and that's maybe it. But then when the Ryder Cup comes around, they're absolutely well behind it. It just seems to almost make more sense 100%. To them.
100%. Well, it's I think by far, when it comes around, it's the biggest sporting occasion in the world. So for us that are European or American, and the ones that manage to again make the team, to have the chance to play all the majors are on a world stage and all golf's on a world stage, but the Ryder Cup is levels above that in terms of how it's viewed.
Yeah.
and the noise factor of the crowd, like you say, every shot seems fist so pumping on the first is something that very, very, very rarely happens. And I would say that Friday morning when you wake up and you're sort of heading to the golf club and you're getting ready, there's nothing comes close to it in terms of the intensity levels of what you feel, and the sort of silence in the air, in the locker room, and the tension, and you're putting, when you're putting your shirt on and stuff, and you look around the room, it's very, very cool.
What's Bethpage going to be like? What's New York 2025 going to look like?
We'll see, won't we? There's it'll be a challenge, that's for sure. I really, really, like everyone, you can already look at it. It's 2 years away. Put it down as a 2-year goal to try and make that team, and I would love to be there playing and as part of the team. But I'm sure the New York crowds will make pretty hostile environment.
Rick will be there, they'll cheering you on in the 16th.
Exactly.
Don't you, Rick?
That's all we need.
What's your favourite Tommy chant? Because you've got some absolute cracking Ryder Cup chants. But one that I can't actually say on air.
Is that your favourite?
Though? Yeah.
Yeah. It's a good one.
I'm sure you won't like that one. But
Claire likes that one.
I mean the class, Tommy. It's just there's so many. I mean, that Sunday night, so I went down into the fan zone on that Sunday night. There was a concert on, I can't remember who it was, DJ now, but the atmosphere was just electric, and I was into one of the bars till almost the closing. And it's scenes that you just do not expect to see. It's a room full of predominantly men, but like literally chanting your name.
Why would you not expect to see that?
It was absolutely AWOL. It was crazy. I was at one point in a massive beanbag, right?
Love a beanbag.
Being tossed up into the air, and like my sunglasses got broken, all sorts. And I don't know as a player, because obviously you don't get to see. I don't know as a player if you really truly understand how much it means to fans.
No, you actually probably don't. And again, for the week of the Ryder Cup, for example, we're very much like you see us playing in front of the biggest crowd we'll ever play in front of, but. We're very much in a bubble, like the whole week. Like you're with the team. The stuff that you do on the range or on the course is obviously in front of everybody that's there. When you finished, you might eat something or get a drink. You might stay in the locker room and have a team talk, or you might do that. Luke might do it back at the hotel. But then you're in a car, you leave, you go to the hotel, you change in your hotel room, and you go down to the team room. You're with your team and our partners. Go to bed, wake up the next day, you do it the same. So you're very much in a bubble. Like you don't get all of that stuff.
I'd tell you what, if any player, you wouldn't get through it with safety precautions, but if any player turned up at one of those bars on that Sunday night, I mean, it was already going off. It would be absolutely crazy. Is an interesting question. How would you deem the success of 2023 to be for you personally? And career
if you look at it I would look at it in two or three different ways, but from a results perspective, very good without winning this year on an individual basis, and that would be something that you would look at that you'd be disappointed. Of course, everybody on the planet wants to win more, and without question, I don't win anywhere near as much as I would like or feel like I might have the opportunity to do so. That might not happen forever. I might win more than my fair share coming up, and I always try and keep a positive spin on that, because when I look at it from a performance standpoint, from a consistency standpoint, and where the level of my game was at, I think it's been arguably this year as high as any of my... I was classed like 17, 18, 19 were my, best years. And I think this year I played easily to a level that was as high as those. So when I look at the performances and the consistency of my game and how I felt on the golf course, I see that as a massive positive, and I'm very, very happy with that and want to continue that. So, and plus you add to that, I think the Ryder Cup was unbelievably special time, moments that I'll have forever. The Open at Hoylake ended up being, very, very sad finish for me in the end, the way it went. But I look back at the feeling that I had on the first tee in front of my home crowd, the first round, leading the Open after the first round, going out last in the Open on Saturday in my home, one of my home Opens, the way I played that week, where I felt like I was probably under... as much pressure as anybody else being at home and stuff. So there was a lot of...
Did it feel more pressure than the Birkdale Open?
In a way, yeah. I think probably more pressure, but at the same time, I think I was more experienced this time to handle it, and I felt a lot more prepared.
Because where the Birkdale Open, you actually started badly in the first round, didn't you?
I shot 78, yeah.
But then did incredible to make the cut, pretty much on the number, right?
Yeah.
Where this time round, you obviously, your expertise and your experience had really shone through the fact you were leading the Open after the first round.
Yeah, like I was playing well, and I started off pretty nervy on that Thursday, and I didn't really hit a decent golf shot until about the fifth. And around that 5th, 6th, 7th, I started to get into the round a bit more, started to like calm down, and then I played really well and got on a good run and putted well. So then sort of found my way into the tournament quite well. And honestly, that week particularly, Friday struggled towards the back end of the round, did well to finish with the where I did, got myself into the last group. And then Saturday, Sunday, I played really, really, really well. And putting let me down. I didn't particularly put badly, couldn't get the ball in the hole, and it just felt hard from there. And it's, you know, like what it's like on link screens is you get days where you just look at the putt, you don't even line it up, and you hit it towards the hole and everything looks like it's going to go in. And I had a weekend where I felt like I couldn't hole anything, and I played so well, and I was really happy with how I played, and I just couldn't make advances on Brian, who did, you know, unreal. And then finish, you know, hit it over the back on 17 and made a triple, but like, you know, very close again to having my joint best finish in a major, and it was at the home one, so there was a lot of amazing things about that I took from it.
Just on that though, we hear, you might have even said this last time we interviewed you, but we hear a lot from tour pros that, you know, you try and treat majors the same as any other tournament, you go into it with the same mindset, and I kind of get that from a kind of consistency standpoint, but it must feel different, the Open, for you, and it's in the Northwest. It has to.
Yeah, it is. I think I think you do try and treat them the same in terms of your preparation, what you do week in, week out. When you get on the golf course, play your game, stay in the present, focus on all the things that you do that you should do that sort of lead to the success that you have in any normal week. But there's no getting away that they are different, mm-hmm. Particularly like a home open, you know what's coming. But I think if you, as long as you're honest with yourself and you prepare for that, like I, you know, very aware, or actually I say very aware of what's going to be, you hope that it's going to be what you think it is. Cause if I went to the first tee and there was nobody around or nobody was supporting me, I'd be like, this is shocking. Like,
what have I done?
So prepare for that. Like, there's going to be a lot of people, there's going to be a lot of noise, there's a lot of expectation on you. You're going to be nervous. You're going to want to try harder because of how much it means to you. And if you, I like writing things down. So like I would write all that down, and then I would, you know, on the other side, I would obviously look at how I feel like I should tackle that. Or, and if I've got that and I've got a plan in my mind, then I feel very much more prepared and then go out. Cause in my experience, maybe not everyone's like this, but those things crop up. And I might have started, for instance, in the Open, I might have started birdie, birdie, birdie. And I'd, you know, my expectations, my emotion would have shot through the roof. And equally, I could have started bogey, 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 and then want to try unbelievably hard and get disappointed or something. So being ready for all those kind of scenarios in a week that means so much to you, that things will be more difficult to, like, do things that you do every week, like stay in the present or, you know, react well or whatever. If you're prepared for them, then
it's almost like a risk assessment.
I think so, yeah. Like, in a way, yeah.
You need to know all the crazy outputs that might happen. Yeah. You know, for example, if you go and double the first, right, what's my plan then?
If
I start birdie, 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 what's my strategy then? Yeah,
and on like a normal, you know, I'm not putting any other tournament down, but on a normal week, I think, you know, you play very regularly, so you're playing 30 events a year, say. If it's on a normal week, you'll do those things pretty naturally.
Yeah.
You understand that there's 72 holes in a tournament, and you kind of, I always kind of see my career as a big long thing. So like any hole doesn't, you might get up and down in the moment, but overall I know deep down I'm, you know, it's one hole out of tens of millions of holes I'll probably play. So like I'm kind of all right about it reacting. Of course, at the time you'll get angry or you'll get upset, but I feel like I'm pretty good at, you know, reacting deep down and getting back to it. But just in those ones where they mean a lot, then.
And not to bring up any sticky situations this year, is there one particular shot that you could wish you could retake this year? And how do you deal with that?
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to BOLLandBranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Do you put it so far back in the memory that it doesn't mean anything?
If I could actually take one shot back, it would be potentially the tee shot off the last in the Canadian Open.
Yes, was that
in regulation play?
That was the. It's a bit of an odd hole, that though, isn't it?
It was only an iron off the tee that then left you like a 5 wood in or something. And it's a strange one. So that week, probably the closest I got to winning all year.
Because you birdied, had an incredible 17. Run, didn't you?
And birdied 16 and 17 to go joint leader, and you're on a par 5, easily reachable, obviously, with an iron in your hand off the tee to hit the fairway, and a birdie wins the tournament. That week, I was actually struggling with my swing a bit.
Really?
And I started the week, and I was hitting it really poor. I was really, really struggling. Spent quite a bit of time on the range having to go through like some different feels to just feel like I could get it going. And I didn't play particularly amazing in the first round and was just sort of steady away. And then I had a really good third round, shot 8 under, I think, in the third round, and ended up in the last group and then played pretty good in the final round. But I actually led putting that week for the tournament.
Wow.
But interestingly enough, like on a week where I didn't feel like I was swinging my best, was the week where
you putted really well.
I putted really well.
I was
you know, stood on the last with needing a birdie to win. I'd probably take that shot back, but it was one of them where it was the same thing I've been struggling with all week. I had like, it's getting a bit quick from the top and stuff, and then a little bit nervous on the last, got a bit quick on a 5 iron, yeah. Missed the fairway. End up making par and then going into a playoff.
You're in a really tricky slot on the right hand side, yeah, on that hole.
Yeah.
Did you go? You didn't go 5 wood, did you?
No, I put 5 wood down, and
the lie
in my
great.
Well, in my defence, I am useless at the rough.
When you say that,
I'm useless at the rough. I had a lesson off Rory at the Ryder Cup at a rough.
No way.
I did, yeah, because. The rough was really thick there, and I know Rory's very good out of it, and we were playing a practice round, and I asked him to help me out there.
It's the 1 week a year you can ask for help.
I'm obviously quite a shallow player, like, yeah. I get in rough, and I either hit a big smother left or a big choppy cut thing that goes like nowhere right.
And I'm always wondering,
I'm always wondering, like, I watch people out the rough and I'm like, they make it look so easy, or they're so good out of it. So I asked Rory to help me. But anyway, back to Canada, like, I looked at the lie. I'm pretty sure a lot of people would have probably gone for it. And I just looked at it, I thought, I'm going to hit this like 40 yards.
Yeah.
So I went to lay up, and I was wedging it great, and I was putting great. So just lay it up in the fairway and like wedge it on, give yourself a putt for it. lo and behold, useless out of rough, carved it into the more rough on a tail soap over there.
And the next shot was really hard, the third shot.
Yeah, a great shot there, actually. Yeah. A great shot and a great putt, ended up making five. But yeah, probably that tee shot would be one that.
When it comes to bad shots, though, everyone listening who obviously plays golf, we've all hit bad shots, we've all missed a putt on the last that was going to be for our best ever score. How much then do you kind of go away and either like just try and forget about it, just move on, it's one shot at a time, or do you kind of look back and think what could have done better? Like, how do you move on from bad shots? I'm sure a lot of people listening want that kind of help.
There's like, I suppose there's a bunch of different like ways you can do it. I would say
you kick the golf bag.
Now this is the Rick Shields approach.
Throw the club forward. Throw the club forward. Blame the caddy. I'll blame Finno. Kick the bag. So one thing I could be better at, for instance, is probably self-talk. I don't talk to myself particularly great all the time, but I'm all right at moving on. Like, I just think, like, for me, when I tee off on the first, I know that I'm going to play 18 holes. So while I'm out for those 18 holes, I'm going to have to hit every shot anyway.
Mm.
Either try and hit a good one or, like, you know, don't.
Yeah.
Nice one. So that's what I sort of try and tell my kids, for instance. You know, everybody's going to get frustrated and angry. You're going to hit bad shots. And again, like, there's things that I can obviously do better. But I do know when I come to every shot, like in my mind, I'm out there for 5 hours. So while I'm out there, you know, hit every shot to the best of your ability and then like figure it out afterwards or something. So that's how I've always looked at it.
Yeah.
I think, you know, everybody's different, but that's just my mindset. So that gives me like the clarity that I will just, you know, try on the next shot and I'll.
Just on that, you mentioned your kids then. I know you said earlier on kind of off camera how much they're loving golf and getting into golf. Do you still love golf like you did when you were a kid?
Yeah, I love golf, yeah.
Really? Yeah. Even though it's your job and you're playing so much, you're still...
I'm Tommy Fleetwood and I love golf.
I'm Tommy Fleetwood and I love...
Is that normal? Absolutely. Is that normal for a tour pro? Do some guys see it as a job? I know it's such a great job and you're so fortunate, but...
You know, I suppose from a professional level, like, golf is my job. It is a job. It's a career and there's... I think I have to be... There's... When it comes to like when I'm working or I'm at a tournament or, you know, I'm practicing before I go to a tournament, say, you have to be very disciplined and I have to work on the exact things that I know I want to work on and get right and what I'm trying to improve on at any given time. And that's one side of it. That's my job side of it, and trying to chase my dreams and, you know, make the most out of my career for as long as I can. I will have it as my career. And then I also think the other side is I love the game of golf. Like, I love playing with my kids. I love playing with my mates. I love going on a chipping green or a pitching area and messing around and trying different things. I love, maybe not today because it's a very important match.
That's a huge
but
match.
I could go out and play golf today and shoot 100 and be just as happy. Like, it doesn't bother me one bit.
Wow.
I'll just enjoy going around and messing around a golf course.
Well, because you know that's not, you know that you can play really good golf as well.
Well, so. Yeah, and I just, you know, I just don't care if I'm playing and it doesn't matter. Like, I just enjoy hitting golf shots or trying something or something, and I do enjoy the game. I do enjoy the game for that, and I enjoy anybody. I enjoy spending time with people that love the game, you know, like, golf has been my life for as long as I can remember.
Forever.
I look at Frankie now, who's six. He reminds me a lot of me when I was that age and I was just getting into the game and I loved it. It was always my favorite thing to do. And you look at it now and like, I obviously live here and it's bizarre that I would come to the Tommy Fleetwood Academy and practice, like, and I have something that is like important to me. But one of my main goals really is that everybody, it's like creating the best environment for you to grow in, or and that's like one of my main goals.
You must be really proud as we sit here at the Tommy Fleetwood Academy. I mean, that must be really, really satisfying for you.
It's cool, yeah. I do love it, and it was wasn't necessarily always something that I had as a dream or a goal, but I guess as I, and I'm still not old, by the way, I'm still like relatively young, but I think for a while now, I sort of, everything, I always feel like everything that I learn in the game is for my, like it is for myself, but then I kind of want to use it.
Yeah.
Maybe it's because I have kids as well, and they're into the game, so I want them to improve. But everything I learn, kind of want to pass on, or the certain beliefs that I will get that, and everybody forges their own like mindset or beliefs, and it'll be from their own experiences. So I've had good and bad experiences that I've learned from every time, and then I'll just try and make them work in like in an academy in like setting.
But like say at evenings here, they were saying it's like 200 kids down here practicing.
It's very, yeah, it is very cool. It's
like,
such
you're inspiring them.
Maybe.
You are. Of course you are. They get to spend time. You're here and they get to spend time, and they might get to come have a picture with you, or that you sign a heart, and they'll look up to you as a real role model, not only here, but at Formby Hall back at home, where you've also got another golf academy. I think you'll, whether you underestimate it, I don't think you should underestimate your inspiration on young talent who are growing up in the game, because as much as yes, you are still young, but you've achieved so much. I think so many young kids will look up to you and go, I want to be Tommy Fleetwood.
that'd be nice. Hopefully they're better than me.
Well, for the hell, you've done all right. But like, like that must be really cool to see it. And you never know, in next 10 years, you know, there might be a superstar that comes out of the Tommy Fleetwood Academy.
That would be a dream. I've said that a few times, but being able to play on tour like against or with like somebody that came through
that'll be cool.
The academy would be like, that would be amazing.
I mean, we've seen it with like Faldo series back in the day, and I'm sure you played in Faldo series, didn't you, back in the day as well?
I chopped it around the Faldo series a couple of times, yeah.
But like, even that back in is there to inspire young talent.
Yeah, absolutely.
And obviously Faldo seeing success from young talent coming through and becoming a tour player and stuff now as well, so I'm excited to see what happens from young talent coming out of Tommy Fleetwood Academies.
I would be surprised if there is. I mean, this place, I knew today when we came here, Tommy Fleetwood Academy, it was going to be good. Your name's on it, it's going to be good. I'll be honest, hands up, it's better than I thought it would be. There's two gyms. There's obviously an amazing putting green, short game area, range. Like this, literally, I said before, this is like, it would make you feel like a tour pro for the day coming here.
Yeah,
it's got everything you'd need and more.
We do have like, we do have an unbelievable facility. I think we have eight pros and two trainers, I think, and it's more like from a day-to-day standpoint, and for the kids and the people that come here, everybody that comes here, those guys are the ones that, you know, the pros are giving them the day-to-day experience. And I think we do have an amazing team here, so we're very, very lucky, like very passionate, always learning, great personalities. And like I say, like from my belief, from an academy, I'm not a coach, and I never will be a coach, like I've always looked for more in my career, and I've always there's always something that you find that works for you, or that you believe in, that you think works universally. And I think the environment, you know, the environment, the mindset, the, you know, the lessons, the discipline, and the people that surround the place are all like, you know, such important things. And that's kind of like my impact on it, if you like. That's what I try and leave. And then the pros are so good that you know, they just take care of everything else.
And who knows, it might be little Frankie Fleetwood.
Frankie's doing being well.
He's a tour pro in the future.
It's very, very good. Hopefully you get a chance to have a chipping comp against him or something.
Oh, that'd be one winner.
Thank
there.
You.
He literally barely hits a golf ball on the range. He's not that interested in hitting golf balls, but he can hit it forward. So at six, that's about enough. Yeah. And then his chipping and putting's really good. So I would love to see Rick Shields.
No, he'll batter me. What? how are you coping with that? So I've got three kids as well. I'm trying to get them into golf. I'm trying to get them encouraged, and they're definitely intrigued about golf. I wouldn't say they're dead into it just yet. We've not quite got a Tommy Fleetwood Academy where we live just at the moment. I think moving to Dubai is the plan. How are you managing that kind of relationship with even getting your kids involved? Are you quite? I'm guessing he's seen what you've achieved and wants to do what Dad does.
Yeah, I think so Oscar and Mo, the two older boys, they play very like into the game, very passionate about it. I obviously play And I think Frankie just ended up wanting to just hang around with us and doing what we want. But it's almost turned into, this is what, when I say he reminds me a lot of me, he'll come home from school. So he gets home from school at 3:30 or something. And he wants to go to the academy. He wants to just come and hang out and practice his golf, like chip and putt. And he gets so much joy out of it that all my job really is to just stay out of the way.
Yeah.
Like I'll have a chipping comp with him and stuff and putt, and then I'll take him out onto the course and we'll play some holes. I'll just tee him off where I think he can reach the green in regulation. But it's like, as long as he is enjoying it, he's 6 years old. Like, I mean, what else is there to do? Like, just make sure he enjoys it. Like, don't get in his way. And it's actually amazing watching. He's had like a handful of lessons hitting it on the range with Dermot, one of the pros here. Loves Dermot and like loves his lessons. But the rest of the time, he never has like, he's never had a chipping lesson, never had a putting lesson. It's amazing how good they can get by either just watching or clearly just doing it.
Well, they just mirror.
It's actually amazing.
Because I'm sure back in the day when it was Tiger's dad, he used to swing, whether he was left-handed or there was a story around him being left-handed.
That was Mickelson's dad.
Was it Mickelson's dad? Yeah. So that was right. So Mickelson was left-handed because he would almost mirror his dad, who was right-handed.
Go,
so he would almost be looking at dad swinging. He'd go, okay, so I'm going to copy that almost.
His dad was a good player.
But yeah, it's amazing what they pick up just by like just watching.
Was this the same kind of upbringing that you had as a kid?
Without the Tommy Fleetwood Academy.
Without sunshine. Were you kind of, did you pick it up naturally? Were you kind of encouraged into it? Did you feel like, because I think professional sports people often have to be encouraged and if to some degree pushed by parents to reach their potential.
Yeah.
Was that kind of the upbringing you had?
I'd say pushed in certain aspects. I think I never needed, I do think most things for the very like elite performers or the ones that go a long way, I think everything has to come from like inside. Everything has to be internal in terms of your desire and your discipline. And I got, like for me, again, I loved the game then, I love the game now. I always wanted to go to the range. I always wanted to play golf. I always wanted to go chipping and putting, and I still do now. And I don't need anybody to give me a push. Like, nobody needs to tell me to go and practice an extra hour or two.
Yeah.
Like, they need to tell me to stop, if anything.
Yeah.
And I needed that then when I was a kid, if you like. But I got pushed in. I got pushed in, like, always trying my hardest, having the right attitude. Being respectful, if you like. I got pushed. My dad hated mistakes, like daft mistakes. He always understood bad shots, and he would never get angry about a bad shot. But if there was something I could avoid by thinking correctly or thinking straight,
a curlish misput or something, a tap like, in, and
he would get a ridiculous shot.
Yeah, he would get really frustrated at it. So I got pushed in those things. But again, I never needed to get pushed in how hard, you know, or wanting to go the golf. And I think, like, I obviously look at Frankie for an example. He's six and he doesn't need that. But there's always an element of pushing, and then there's different obstacles or different distractions that get in the way. And I think when it gets to probably teenagers, I would always look at Tiger Woods or watched the David Beckham documentary recently, and you know, it's very easy to look at David Beckham and think he's like the coolest human on the planet.
Yeah.
And he said very clearly, and the thing he said, going out wasn't for me.
Nope.
Never wanted to party, never wanted to do this. I wanted to go and practice. I wanted to hit free kicks and stuff. And like, it's understanding that those people that you might look up to did things that you wouldn't, that you don't see.
Correct.
Or things that you might, you know, other friends might think you're lame for doing and stuff like that. And I think at that point you just need kind of pushing to do that, and then, you know,
it was like the King Richard film.
Yeah, the Williams sisters.
The Williams sisters, and that kind of showed the discipline. You've got Serena Williams, you've got like Lewis Hamilton's dad, you've got Tiger Woods' dad, who have seemed to like have almost over pushed to
like
some
a protective
degree.
It's like a protective parent that can see that can see a bigger picture, and I guess as a young adult or a kid, you don't see that as easy. It's very easy to have a dream, it's very easy to have a vision, but actually do the things that in the long term
I think sometimes as well, you see like some of these kind of pushy parents, they're trying to live a dream for the child that they couldn't ever dream. I think someone like yourself who's so successful, you've dreaming your own dream, that the child then can just kind of look at that as inspiration, just enjoy it, like, you know.
That'd be nice. I think, you know, of course, like, you're going to get things right and wrong as a parent, and there's plenty of stuff I'm sure I get wrong and right, but you know, it's our first time, isn't it? You're only trying your best and you're only doing what you think is right.
It's hard. It's the hardest job in the world.
Just leave everything to mom, it'll be fine.
How do you feel or think about professional golf, the state of professional golf right now?
It's a good question.
Because there's lots of changes since we last did a podcast 2 years ago.
There's lots of changes. I mean, look, there's still a lot of tournaments. There's four majors that are career defining every year still. There's a lot of money knocking around. And, there's amazing players and amazing golfers to play against wherever you are.
Yeah.
Do you think the money's good for the game?
Well, it's good if you're making it.
Well, that's it. if you're one of the players, don't get me wrong.
It's hard to ever say that money is bad for the game. And I'm a professional golfer. I can't say money is bad for the game, because I'm one of the ones that's actually making it. I don't know as. Like, for me, I am ultimately kind of a purist in terms of my dreams are still the same. I still want to try and be the best golfer in the world at some point, even if it was for a day. And the Open is still, I'm still chasing the Open and that. And those are my dreams. And as a purist, that's kind of what I believe in. And again, it's probably easy for me to say when I'm financially okay and things are fine and I'm like very settled. Other people might say, well, you don't know what you're talking about. Like, it's just one of those things, and I think you can only ever make your own individual decisions and choices and whatever anybody else does. I mean, I'm not going to leave one ounce of sleep on whatever anybody else does. No. Like, I'm still on my journey, and I think that's just what everybody kind of should focus on, like their own life.
How do you think it's all going to pan out? What do you think the next 5 years going to look like for professional golf?
It's going to be a different ball.
That's another topic.
And I don't know. Golf as a game is still growing.
Yeah,
like massively. And I think the opportunities are. I can't imagine the opportunities becoming less. Like, I feel like there's going to continue to be more and more opportunities, more and more growth in the game, in both sides of the game, amateur and professional. What the tours will look like, who has any idea? Because that changes like daily.
What do you want it to look like? What would be your what would be your blue sky scenario of professional golf in 5 years? Do you want everyone back together? Do you think it can happen?
I'm sure anything seems possible. Is it a bad answer if I say, like, I don't really...
No. Well, I don't think any of us know.
No, but I was going to say I don't really care. not that I don't care, but it's that out of my realm of...
Yeah.
I've had no part in any of the decision making, nor do I want it, by the way.
I don't know,
without sounding like I'm sitting on the fence, I have very little like opinion on what's going on, except for I know the opportunities that I have and I know where I'm going to be playing. Like the rest, I mean, like I'm in a position where whatever the decisions are made, I'm going to look at where is best for me to become the best golfer I can possibly be and where's best to chase my dreams still. And until that changes, like, I'm just going to take the decisions as they come and look at that.
It's probably something that's more the fans almost in a way that I think from a fan's perspective, well, we want to see the best players playing against each other, which we get obviously in the major championships.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's players that, like I say, that's my choice. That's my decision. And that's how I, you know, look at it. Everybody looks at it differently. And I don't mind how anybody looks at the game and what is best for their careers and what's best for their family or what they want to do, where they want to play. That's for them. And everybody's going to do their own thing and do what they think is right. And that's, you know, again, like, I don't want to give an answer that's like sitting on the fence, but that is literally genuinely what I believe and how I spend my life thinking.
Well, it's like, you know, you look at that, I won't name individuals, but you look at some guys who have gone to live and where they were in their career and what they had achieved or hadn't achieved, and you think, you can't blame, I personally couldn't sit here and say that's a stupid mistake when they've got set up for life and, you know, whatever, but who knows? There's a lot of discussions ongoing.
I just feel like as a fan and people who, I just don't know if it's in the best spot right now, and I can't see an end to it, and that's kind of frustrating.
And I,
you know what I worry about the most, Tommy, as well, with all this, and not that you need, as professional golfers, don't need to worry, I just don't want our sport to look greedy.
There's going to be numbers that are thrown around that they've already, you know, numbers have already been thrown out around there, and there's going to be more, I'm sure. It's a bit daft, isn't it? they're unbelievable amounts, but who are we to like say that that's, you know,
I look at it two ways, because I get what you're saying, and it's, you know, we don't want golf to be all about money. We know football, the Premier League now, it's all about money. But at the same time, if there's a lot of money in golf, they have to make that money by advertising, and you'd like to think they want to try and pushing the game out globally to more eyeballs. It has to pay for itself.
As long as it filters down. If somehow it filters down to grassroots level to get more people into the game, so it actually benefits the whole of game, not just lining the pockets of select individuals. But again, I've said this from day one. I fully agree that professional golfers should earn as much money as physically possible, because you deserve it. You're unbelievably talented. I get that. It's just, I think now it's become at the forefront of people's minds, the money element. Like anytime someone wins, it's the first thing you see now.
Sometimes it's not about
the score. Yeah. It's not about the trophy. It's not about. It's like the first thing you see now is how many millions
of tours they'll get against each other.
Of course, isn't it? and it's one of those things. You know, it's like a businessman. It's their job to make as much money as possible, and as a golf purist, it's your job to try and be the best golfer you can be. If the two align, great. Is it going to turn that? There's, you try and do one or the other. I don't know, but and again, like you say, as long as it comes down, as somebody that believes in the game so much and that loves the game, the more people that can get into the game for whatever reason and benefit from friendships, from health, from enjoyment, from something to focus on, from the disciplines that they'll learn from the game, then the better, you know.
Definitely.
For me, so
I think with the money though as well, it's a short term story. It might be a headline for a day, but like, I don't know how much Cameron Smith won when he won the Open. Don't care. All I'm thinking of is he won the Claret Jug at the 150th in front
of the old course. Only majors that still have that.
Potentially.
I don't think a lot of other tournaments have that anymore.
But I think that, again, so I think that becomes down to the how many events there are. If there was fewer events that all mean a lot more.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, like the players obviously mean so much, et cetera, et cetera. I think it's just the scheduling as well. There's so many events. As a fan, it becomes hard to know, like, well, what's this week? Or that's not that big of an event. Or, but then Rory's in Dubai. And it gets confusing, but I think it will have to change, won't it?
What do you want to be remembered for in 10 years? Or even longer than 10 years? Let's say you're coming to the end of your career, okay? You're hanging up your golf shoes. You're about to retire from the game. What do you want to be remembered for?
I'd like to be somebody that... I'd like to get somewhere to feeling like I reached my potential. I've got my dreams that I would love to achieve, and I'll never run away from them, and I'll be chasing them the whole time.
The opening world number one.
Those are out there. I've dreamt of them since I was very, very young, and whether I achieve them or not might not even be the most important thing. It's that I've got something to chase.
That's
and
your
it's
North
something
Star.
That's something that will keep me working every day, and something that I'll enjoy chasing for the rest of my life potentially, and I might never get there. I might actually have got as close as I ever get, but that's not the point. It's having something to chase. I absolutely want to leave a legacy on, the academy is very important to me. And how people develop in the game and what they gain from the game. That's something very important to me. And I would love to, as much as I, might achieve or may achieve or may not achieve, still at the side of that, I would love for people to think of Tommy Fleetwood or the Tommy Fleetwood Academy as something that's doing so much good for people.
Great.
So that's something. And, I would love to be Rick Shields in a 10 shot.
Well, I get that.
That's probably
the third goal.
That's
probably
get realised.
World number one.
Third goal. Well, again, when you talk about dreams that you're chasing, whether you achieve them or not, it's something to aim at. Like, that's one of them.
I can guarantee if that is one of the goals, that's one that can easily be ticked off. Yeah. I think you. I love the fact that that's not changed. I love the fact that hopefully in 10 years, you've achieved, well, even shorter term than that. Next year, you achieve the goals,
That'd be great, yeah.
But I feel like it's nice that those haven't changed, that it's still about performance. It's still about, obviously, you want to look after your family. You want to be settled for life. I totally get that. As I said before, I don't mind any professional golfer doing incredibly well because you deserve every penny. But I love the fact it's still world number one. It's still the Open. It's still Ryder Cup legend, but potentially Ryder Cup captaincy. Is that kind of in the dreams?
Probably. I think I've got a lot to learn. My Hero Cup captaincy went very poorly at the start of the year, didn't it? I've got a 0-1 there as captains.
But you learned a lot. You got to cut your teeth somewhere.
I did learn a lot. Actually, in the academy, it's one of my proudest things of my career, that captain in that team. They've got the locker. That Hero Cup, we tried to... I don't even know if people remember the Hero Cup. It was so early on in the year.
I must admit, when you said it, I was like, oh, yeah.
Well, I remember it. But, obviously me and Fran got asked to be captains of those teams, GB and I against Europe. And there was a lot of things. That was one of the things after Whistling Straits that we were talking about, literally on the plane home from America, that we wanted. It used to be called the Seve Trophy.
That was the Seve Trophy, wasn't it? Yeah.
But also before... the Ryder Cup in 2018, we had the Eurasia Cup where Europe played Asia. So we'd always had like a team event, and we felt like we'd lacked that because we either didn't have the rookies that came in, didn't have as much experience in the team format because we've been playing professional golf for a long time. You don't get any team games. And also like you get pairings from those events.
Have like the President's Cup, don't they?
Yeah, exactly. So that was something that we wanted. Hero Cup came about, me and Fran got the chance to be captains, but we had a lot of tried to make things as similar to a Ryder Cup as possible. So like you walked into the team room, GB and I team room, you had everybody's locker and the kit and everything, and my locker is in the academy there. That's on show, because it was really cool because all the players left a little message and signed the locker at the end of the week, which even as a captain where we got beat, they were still very pleasant with me.
That's really awesome.
Just on that then, regardless of tours though, is team golf something that I take it you enjoy? Is that something you could envision a future of in some capacity? Or do you just prefer that grind on your own?
That's a very good question as well. Team golf's great. Like, I don't know whether it's because we don't get to do it as often.
Yeah, it's that nice change.
It becomes so cool when you do it. But without doubt, like the family that we become at the Ryder Cup or the at the Hero Cup, the team environment that you create, how much you support each other, how much you celebrate everybody's like good shots when they've won a hole or hold a putt, it's all brilliant. And winning and losing as a team is actually better than doing it on your own. Most of the time. Although I still for my dreams and ambitions, I can't really do that in a team sport. No. So,
well, like I say, winning as a team, I can imagine that atmosphere afterwards is just electric. Like, I managed to, I was lucky enough to gate crash the after party briefly.
Yeah.
Not the after party, not the players, but like,
I don't think I made the after party.
But like, just even seeing that where you've got yourself, your family, your friends around, you know, the players coming down in the bloody pajamas, the Ryder Cup pajamas, like that, you don't get that if you individually win, do you? It's you, your caddy, your team around you. And kind of really, it's a much smaller affair. And
very often you end up travelling somewhere else anyway.
Yeah, exactly. You can't really go out and get hungover too much.
I think if you grow up, I don't have that much experience in it. I need to win more to let you know.
I think if you grew up playing golf, obviously we all did, from being young, that was my sport. I was, obviously wasn't great at it, but I did miss that team element. My mates who played football, part of a team and stuff, when you just kind of, obviously we had junior teams against other clubs, and I used to enjoy that quite a lot.
Yeah, yeah. Playing county golf was epic.
Yeah. Well, there's more Love pressure on you, isn't it? It's you know, if you're the final man and you're on the green and everyone's around.
Do the Tommy Fleetwood just win it and just
do the old Tommy Fleetwood squat and just dominate.
Hit a lucky one.
Tommy, thanks for your time. It's been a pleasure as always. Anything else that we didn't cover?
I'm sure there's lots, but I'll just have to come on
again. Save for part three.
I think the golf ball debate is very interesting, but we need to know a little bit more about that at the moment, don't we?
Because
that's looking like it's going to be a universal thing now. It's not even looking like...
It is. It's for everyone, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I was a bit surprised that it was for everyone in a way, but I'm someone that golf courses, we only have so much land, so you either have to change the way you make golf courses or do something about it and stop the ball going so far. I never want to stop somebody's skill of being a long hitter and making that a closer margin, or being an amazing driver of the ball and making that a closer margin, but overall, from a long-term perspective, there's golf courses out there that do stand the test of time, like a Hilton Head, a Colonial. I always think that courses where the ball is uncontrollable out the rough, if you like, got somebody doing maintenance at the Tommy Fleetwood Academy. We're making the rough uncontrollable. But do you know where you've always got a shot, but there's like flyers, or the course is firm, greens are small. There are obvious ways of combating like long hitting, but you still want to watch people hitting the drivers and still want to watch people taking shots on. So you've got to find the best of both worlds. And, I don't know what the right way to do that is, but can't keep making golf courses. Can't keep making golf courses longer. That's not the answer. Being able to keep long, good driving, long, really good driving as a strength and as an advantage, while, making golf a bit more sustainable in terms of the land that we have is probably the next challenge, if you like, and we'll see what the best way to do that is.
I'm excited about all the new YouTube videos we can make with the new golf ball. It'd be like Christmas has come early.
Just one last thing then before we wrap it up. Speaking of golf equipment, while we're on that topic, we don't want to name the Drive EX. This podcast probably go out before the embargo, but I'm guessing you've been tweaking with the new TaylorMade driver and potentially putting that in the bag. What's that like for you, that process of putting a new driver in? You're known for your driving, obviously super straight. It must be a big task, or is it simple these days? What's that like for you?
Sometimes it's easy, sometimes it's not as easy. So this one in particular, I used it at the last event of the year.
Yeah.
Tiger and Rory were using it. If Tiger and Rory want to use it, you know that it's going to be put in early.
That you're allowed to use it.
This one's been a really good driver. So I don't even know. Again, when you go back to having a manufacturer that works for you, TaylorMade, Adrian, that fits all my clubs with TaylorMade, let him do the work. He knows what's likely to work for you. And this driver was pretty much straight in as it was. And for me, it's launched a bit higher, slightly less spin. It's been very, very, all the good things, it's been very, very good. And sometimes you just get a driver that might not quite, work straight away, and then it takes a bit more time to get one in there. And I think it definitely varies year on year. Stealth 2, that went straight in. That was a really good driver, and this one again has been really good. So
again, going back to the F1 analogy, it's almost like some years Mercedes don't bring out the best car, or it needs a bit more tweaking for the driver, or whatever it may be. It's like a driver that comes out from any brand.
Well, and then obviously different head models, but I suppose it's hard for TaylorMade or any brand to bring out a driver that's going to suit you, suit Rory, suit Tiger.
And suit the bloody general world of golfers too.
It might suit you the colours this year a bit more though.
Colours are bad.
The colours are bad for you.
There's a bit of blue. I told Tiger, nobody likes red. Red's been no good to anyone.
Well, right. Amazing with your time again. Thank you, Tommy. Thanks for having us here at the Tommy Fleetwood Academy here at the DP World Golf Performance Centre at Jumeirah Golf Estates.
Very good. Well done.
First
that
time.
Was fire.
In the edit, that'll just be the first time. Thanks for listening. Thanks for watching. And we shall see you all very soon.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.